meteor scatter, moon bound. Then you got your microwave people above 300 meg. They do things like rain scatter, and super refraction phenomena, aurora, moon bounce. And the moon bounce, of course, form any of these modes of operation can again be using sideband, single sideband, AM, FM, also WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor type, what is that now called? Ooh, can't even think of the name of the protocol, but it's a series of four tones, so it's a subset of packet or radio teletype brought up to speed. Let's see. Aircraft reflection, I've done that. Building bounce reflection, I've done that. I'm not sure how many I've listed so far, but you can see there's lots of protocols, lots of modes of operation, lots of frequency regions, lots of reflecting objects. I haven't even included the ionosphere here. D layer, E layer, F1, F2 layer. I've already mentioned the forward propagated tropospheric scatter and meteor scatter. Super refraction, sub refraction. I think I've listed a good percentage of them. I think you can see that any kind of a wireless technique with any kind of a protocol connected with a computer or with a human being is, in my mind, a mode of operation. When it comes to getting the signal, let me drop from the shack to the antenna. There's different modes of operation there. The very early ham radio operators in, let's say, 1915 would locate the shack in the third floor attic of a wooden house, and the transmitter set on a wooden table, and half the dipole went out the east window and the other half went out the west window of the attic, and the transmitter sat in the middle. After that, we started using open wire line, coax cable. A few of the really far out guys used G-line. The modern day very advanced guys will be using what's called a beam waveguide, which is the method by which you have an illuminator dish on the ground aimed up at a fly swatter. It's called a periscope antenna system. So there, the transmission line is literally the air that goes up the side of the tower in between the illuminating dish and the fly swatter. So when it comes to optical now, you've got ham radio operators that are doing laser work, all kinds of optical. I think the current distance record on optical is something like 158 miles. The current distance record on 10 gigahertz is well above 1,000 miles. You would never believe that these kind of numbers are possible. So the hams do use almost EC to light. There are hams using super low frequencies, 150 kilohertz, another whole area. So I think you see some of the frequency regions, modes of operation, modes of transmission, modulating, demodulating. We haven't even gotten into synchronous demodulation techniques, digital signal processing techniques, which can give you a signal-to-noise ratio improvement, particularly with this fancy weak signal Joe Taylor. Just to give you one other controversy that's going on right now, let me drop. You take a guy who has spent 10 or 15 or 20 years of his life with state-of-the-art equipment doing moon bounce, 400 square feet of antenna, 1,500 watts of power into it, half dB of noise figure front end, and he's overcoming at 432, 263 dB of loss to the moon and back, isotropic loss. That's a lot of decibels, decibels, 263 dB. That's on 432. By the time you get up to 1296 and 10 gigs, the numbers get closer to 290 dB of loss. When a person is using that kind of a mode of operation for 10 or 15 years, and he racks up X number of states, X number of countries, and along comes the Joe Taylor technique, K1JT, where a guy with, on 2 meters, for instance, a single Yagi on the chimney of the house, wait till the moon is on the horizon or near the horizon, 150 watts of power, and because the WSJT digital signal processing technique is capable of digging 28 decibels into the noise and giving you probably 90 or 95% copy done by a computer, and it prints out the message on the screen. And because the message is printed out by a computer and not done by a set of human ears at one sitting in front of a rig transmitting a full set of call letters, letters both ways. I'm now listing what constitutes a valid QSO. A valid QSO is a full set of call letters in both directions, at least one unknown piece of information, single strand, location, whatever, and then a confirmation of that information, Rogers, in both directions. That's a real QSO, usually done with one set of human ears in front of the rig at one sitting. Well, along comes the WSJT technique, where the computer is doing the demodulating of a signal that's 28 dB below the noise, and it prints it out on the screen. The ham radio operator in this case is doing the right job of getting the frequencies just right, the angles of the antennas just right, calculating where the moon's going to be, is there a mutual window between you and the guy on the other side of the earth that you're talking to, and so on. There's still a lot of human intervention, but the final detection is not taking place in your ears. It's taking place with you reading off the phosphor of that screen, or the liquid crystal screen. And so the old-timers are complaining about the fact that, hey, this is unfair. These guys with this new technique in 6 months do what I did in 10 years, and they're doing it with a peanut whistle equipment by comparison. Well, that's the progress. That's the way ham radio is. I think, to be fair, there should be separate lists, but I think you see some of the kinds of different kinds of ham radio. I guarantee there's at least 25 in there, 26. Since you've challenged me, Gordon, I am going to, within the next week, try to make a slightly more formal list. I wonder if it's sort of what you were looking for, Gordon. And will this satisfy the fairly high-tech...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Will this satisfy the high-tech people in Bergenfield? W2KTT, and I'm having a little fun with you, Gordon. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there were two aspects to the question. One was, whatever the list is, it is. Because it probably gives room for additions, and you kind of suggested that. And number two, the paradigm that's used to create the categories. So you have a framework from which to operate. Now, other people might have a different reference framework, because there's all sorts of things that you didn't mention. Like various kinds of public service work. The guy who only likes to build things that other people use, you know. And he might deploy them, but, you know, he doesn't want to use them. He wants other people to use them. You know, that's, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that going on, too. But that's excellent list. That was a fine list. I would look forward to seeing whatever you have going forward. Reason being is that I sometimes think it might be fitting to raise a subject or solicit people who can raise a subject for each of these nets. I mean, you have your panel of experts. I do too, but I'm very blessed that they mostly deal with transmission line and antenna kind of goodies. Mostly focused on HF, but we have a blessing of X to call on. But it might be nice to have topics on these nets from time to time. I find that to be very, very productive and informative and useful. So, obvious starting point would be such a list. So anyway, that was kind of my point. But I hadn't even thought of it until I just listened to your intro. So thank you, Dick. Godspeed, and I'm just going to listen out on the net tonight. So it's always a pleasure. K2RIW, the great W2TTD.
Very glad you called in, Glenn. Do so more often. Yeah, you brought to my attention not only the philosophy, in other words, of doing public service and emergency communication, but I completely forgot about all of the portable techniques. Any of the 10-gig operators take great pride in having vehicles that are festooned with antennas, and they either operate from the vehicle or from a tripod on mountaintop, beachfront, and so on. So locations, portable locations, and equipment that can tolerate cold weather, high wind. I'm laughing a little bit because anybody who's ever operated a dish on a tripod on top of a mountain, you got to ask them the question, how often has a gust of wind come along and blown over your tripod and the rig that's sitting behind the tripod, behind the dish on top of the tripod, goes smashing to the ground? And you say all kinds of four-letter words and and feel kind of stupid that you didn't tie it down with the right kind of a weight to stop it from doing that ahead of time. Various kinds of portable operation, field operation, portable operation, as a rover. A lot of the 10 gig operation is people moving from point A to point B, particularly in California and the Boston area. These guys will operate for a couple hours on mountain A and then go over to mountain B and then over to mountain C, and they publish ahead of time what mountain they're going to be on at what time so people know where and when to look for them, and function able to keep up that schedule. Liaison work, where these guys, 80% of the time during the contest, will either tail gun or get on the calling frequency most frequently used on the East Coast, 146.26 megacycles, 144.26, single sideband, upper sideband, and you get on there, plus or minus 10 kc, depending on the traffic, and say, I'm located at such and such town or beachfront or mountaintop, and I'm looking for 10 gig contacts. Please call me on 144.260. Tell me where you are. We'll line up our 2-meter antennas and line up our 10 gig, three degree beamwidth antennas at each other, and start blasting away. And there's even a subset of that where, in order to line up the dish, you do a cross alignment on each end, and one of the guys on 2 meters plays back the signal that he's hearing on 10 gig, while the other guy with the high power transmitter pushes his dish back and forth to maximize the signal he hears coming back on 2 meters, and then they reverse the procedure, and the other guy swishes his dish. And then when everything's all lined up correctly, they stop using the liaison frequency 2 meters and transfer all the information back and forth on 10 gigs. This is
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now, in most of your amateur radio contests, essentially all of the communication should take place on amateur radio frequencies. However, the rules get loosened a bit when it comes to 10 gigs and above, the real microwave frequencies, where there the main motivation is not to prove that you're a great operator. It's to prove that your electronics has the right threshold on receiver sensitivity, noise figure, dish accuracy of the parabolic dish, and accuracy of the feed horn placement, transmitter power output, so that you and Mother Nature's mode of propagation will support the contact from point A to point B. So you're studying equipment and you're studying propagation, and you're not studying human beings per se on a 10 gig contest. Therefore, it is legal to call somebody up on a cell phone and say, hey, aim your antenna at me. I know you're on mountain A, but you haven't aimed down here to the south where I am. Please do that now, and let's make a QSO on 10 gigs. So it's perfectly legal on the 10 gig band to use packet communication. I guess you could do it, what is this, cell phone type thing? Instant messaging, cell phone, everybody goes to a particular website, transfer information, and so on. In other words, the method by which you initiate the contact on the 10 gig and above contest is perfectly legal. It's a confirmation and it's a gentleman's agreement that the real information got passed back and forth on the microwave frequency. So part of what I, from time to time, let me drop. From time to time, I mention the fact that there are approximately 26 kinds of ham radio. Is that every one of us can get bored with whatever we're doing. The guys who do nothing but super weak signal moon bounce by Morse code never get a chance to really hold a rag shoe with anybody, and they start getting tired of it eventually in some cases. Other cases, the guy says, gee, buy this equipment that I've assembled with my own hands in my own backyard. I'm talking to people worldwide by bouncing it off another heavenly body. Just the sheer technology of that enthralls them, and they're willing to keep doing it. But still, the main thing we amateurs do, in my opinion, other than fiddle with technology and learn our art, the main thing we do is communicate. We talk to each other. We transfer ideas. On almost every QSO, whenever a guy is really having a conversation, not just hello, goodbye, send me a card because you're on this particular South Sea island. Whenever you have a real conversation with somebody, What are you using for a transmitter? What are you using for a receiver? What are you using for an antenna? What are you using for a feed line? Do you like that brand of transmitter? Have you tried the so-and-so variation of it? Have you tried putting an amplifier on? We compare equipment. We communicate with each other and teach each other various ways of doing things better. And a smart person who's getting into the hobby at first is going to be, even though he's a smart person, he's going to be overwhelmed. He's going to look into a catalog and there's a zillion different brand names and model numbers he can buy. If he manages to do some listening with a receiver that he borrows from somebody and talks to a few of his friends and get some word-of-mouth testimonials that the so-and-so rig is a real oldie but goodie, you can buy it on the used flea market or on eBay and buy it at 10% of the original price or 10% of what it would cost you for an equivalent rig today. And you can get a lot of bang for your dollar if that's what you want to do. So we amateurs communicate what we think is valuable information to each other about our technology or about our lifestyle. One of my favorite things to mention, let me drop, is that you can really get a chance to understand each other's culture. In theory, it would be nice to talk to a guy in some country where he does speak English, even though it may not be very good English, but he's living in some country you know nothing about, and you simply ask him the question, hey, Jose, when you walk out of your front door in the morning going to work, and you open that front door, tell me what you see. What is it like? That in theory should open up a whole series of conversations in which you begin comparing lifestyles. So what we discuss on amateur radio doesn't always have to be technology. It can be lifestyles. Hey, this country is fun to live in. I'm able to do this, this, and this, but your country hasn't yet started doing that. So you got to be careful not to have to end up doing too much bragging where you make it sound like you think you're better than them. But still, I've heard of a story. I'm going to give you another crazy example. And I think there's some truth behind this one because I've heard it from a number of different sources. During World War II, a man is walking through the woods in a Japanese-occupied territory. And through the woods, he starts hearing a familiar sound. And he recognizes the sound of Morse code being picked up by a Japanese receiving station. And then transmission takes place, and he recognizes the fist of the man doing the transmitting. He suddenly realized this is a friend of his that he had talked to in Japan before the war began. And they would talk back and forth in Morse code, and he recognized each other's fist. Here these two guys are on opposite sides of this particular war. And to make a long story short, they didn't shoot each other. they had an eyeball contact in a very rural area because he was the lone radio operator at a particular radio station. And this American soldier, ham radio operator, you could say didn't do his duty. In theory, if the story had come out much, much earlier, he'd be court-martialed for what he did. But they didn't shoot each other. They talked a little bit and separated and said, hey, for the next 20 years, we can't mention this. And is that good or is that bad? We get into the philosophy of that till the cows come home. I know I'm getting pretty far left the field of what Gordon was asking. Now, almost everybody who signed in tonight said they didn't have a question. I'm going to give you guys another chance. Pipe up right now. Who out there has got a real question? Because in theory, we have the staff of experts present ready to give you answers 95% of the time. A2RIW and TechNet, my name is Dick, and I'm listening.
2EO, Dick.
W2EWK, Dick.
Okay, I heard Rich and Eugene, but Eugene was doubling with somebody. Who else was in there with Eugene?
WB2CUK.
Brooklyn, Dick. How are you?
Okay, I heard Bill CUK and somebody who said Hawaii. Who was that?
Well, Frank WB2BXO in Brooklyn. Mel and I missed you this weekend.
Yes, I know, Frank. But I was supposed to visit the Kings County Radio Club set up at Floyd Bennett Field. A buddy of mine asked for my help, and I got tied up to something. I'm sorry, didn't make it. Rich, N2EO, you're the first on the list. Go right ahead.
I'm dealing with radio exactly, but new technology. I want kind of a high-tech
universal remote for an HDTV. I got four devices here, HD with audio video units, VCR, TV player. Logitech is making these remotes that can program over the internet with a computer to a USB player. It's called the Harmony One. And basically, Logitech needs a database of I don't know how many thousands of pieces of equipment on file on their database. You set up an account, which they don't charge you extra for. And basically, you plug in your device and download the parameters, customize it, set it up. So, for instance, if this thing has a touch screen on it, I can tell it to touch the area that says watch TV. It'll turn on the TV, turn on the satellite box, set the proper inputs on the HD set, and allow me to watch TV. If I turn it off, tell it play a VCR tape, it'll set the input for the VCR tape, for the proper input, turn on the set, turn on the VCR, and play a tape. So it took me all day the other day to configure this unit. I'm hoping maybe Eric is on frequently. I'm going to call Logitech, but maybe somebody knows. I have a Boston Acoustic HD radio, digital radio. And I went to their list. They do not have digital radios on their list. I'm wondering if anybody happens to know, because sometimes one company's remote will mimic another company's remote. If anybody knows the cross reference for the Boston Acoustic HD radio, like I say, they don't have any HD radios on the Logitech database. Back to you, Dick. A little left of center, but maybe somebody knows. Maybe Eric's on frequency in 2EO.
Yeah, I'm going to ask that question, Rich. Rich, your audio is one quarter to one eighth of what its normal volume is. Either somebody's turned down your mic gain, or you're using a brand new rig, or that particular mic got dropped. Nice, clean audio, but nowhere near enough of it. So I let you know that one. So with this remote control for his high-def television, Harmony One, I think it's called, you go to the website called Logitech, which allows you to reprogram it for almost every other piece of equipment in the world. Rich is now asking for his Boston Acoustic high-definition radio, his digital radio. Does anybody know of a way to find a way for him to program his remote control so it'll also control his digital radio, his Boston Acoustic digital radio? Anybody got any information on that subject? Give us your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Accessing IRLP.
Okay, somebody has said XS IRLP. I'm going to give you enough delay for you to give me the whole message, and your audio is extremely loud. I'll back off a little bit and start again with your message, sir. Okay. Maybe Rich got something out of that, but I did not. Anyone else with any further comments on that particular subject, give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2MDP.
KC2MDP. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I got a question for Rich. Does he have a remote for that digital radio?
Yeah, Don, good question. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, okay. By the way, Dick, I'm talking up on the mic. Is this any better?
You're now up to 80% of the right volume, Rich. Go ahead.
All right, maybe something happened to this this mic. I don't know. All right. Yes, I do. I have the original remote. I know what he's getting at. It has a learn mode for the infrared, but that gets awfully tedious to program all those functions in. That was what I was going to do if maybe somebody didn't know the cross reference.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve. I bet you got a way around this one.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to suggest is to learn, because I have basically the same remote. It's a Logitech remote, and some of the equipment I have is, you know, fairly old and the database didn't support it, so it had a learn feature. Now, what I found out with a learn feature is you just got to press a couple of buttons. It'll basically ask you, you know, push the on-off button, push the channel button, push such-and-such button, and it should, you know, automatically learn all the other features on this thing, and I found that worked for me. Now, I don't know if Rich tried it, but it can't hurt to give it a shot. Basically, it took me maybe about an hour or so. It is a little bit tedious trying to look up everything and cross-reference everything, but I'd say maybe an hour, hour and a half tops. Back to you.
Very good. Owen, sounds to me like you ought to give it a try, Rich. N2EO.
Okay, Dick, I will. I'd like to know, I haven't used the learn function except one function. Do you have to use the learn function with the computer, Steve? Or is it just a matter of holding the original remote to the back of the Harmony 1? Or do I have the computer on it? And if so, I assume there's a menu option?
Rich, I don't exactly remember. It's been a couple of months since I did this, but I think you just pointed, you know, remote to remote, and, you know, it'll ask you to hit certain keys, and then, it, you know, it basically tells you to, you know, try it on the device and see if it works.
Okay, you said it asked you to... I assume you have the computer hooked up to the Harmony 1 through the USB cable, Steve?
Yeah, that's correct, you know, and it'll tell you, you know, hit the on-off function, then hit the channel function, and, you know, depending on what kind of device it is, you know, it asks you to hit, you know, four or five buttons, and then basically tells you, you know, give it a try on the certain device and see if all the functions work on it.
Okay, well, I am going to try that while the net's on. I assume you went to the software, which... I don't know if you remember, I'm using the latest software, 7.1. What did you do, bring up devices, and is there a menu option for the learn mode within the software?
Yeah, like I said, Rich, it's been a while since I've done this. Trying to think back, I do believe, you know, if you can't find the device, I think there's a function there that you can, you know, automatically go into the learn mode. And, you know, and then it basically step-by-step tells you how to program the device.
All right, I'm gonna try that right now. I have the laptop up here. So while the net's going on, I'm going to see where the devices are, maybe you select none. And, I don't know, or maybe there's a word that says learn. I don't know. I'll go through that because I just learned how to do the devices I had that were in the database, which is everything else. Dick, let me turn it back to you. I'm trying to speak up. I hope the audio's okay. Maybe the mic got damaged. K2RIW, Tech on Weimark, and 2EO.
Your audio's quite good now, Rich. And so something did happen, and your mic gain went down. All right, the next person who signed in at this period was Eugene, W2EWTK. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Eugene.
Okay, Dick, W2EWK. I just got a Kenwood TM-701A. And the problem is that it does not want to hold its memory. I took the radio apart looking for the memory battery, and I cannot find it inside the radio anywhere. I imagine it's in the front of the radio. Can you tell me how to get to the memory battery? I know it's in the front of the radio, but I took the case apart and I still can't find it. Do I have to get a mouse? See if he can find the memory battery. USL, W2E.
Sounds like Bill's got an answer for that one. WP2CUK, I think it is. Go ahead, Bill.
I'm not really too familiar with it, but a lot of times what they do, they hide the memory battery in the front panel. You'd have to take the front panel off, and that's where all the digital stuff is. And most of the radios I've worked on, they do have the memory battery on the front panel. If you haven't found it on the chassis, that's what I would do. See if you can take the front plastic piece off and The battery might be behind there.
South Africa. Sound good.
First piece off, and I went a little further, taking the wall off, but I still couldn't find it. Do you know where it is at?
No, I'm not familiar with all the different models, but some of the 2 meter rigs I've worked on have the battery on the display. They usually use the flat button cells. I forget the number, but they're flat. They're not like a regular battery. It's like a button cell that they usually use. And there's some radios, the newer ones, don't even use that. They have flash memory. They don't even need the battery. So try and download the service manual off the web. That will show you where it is.
Roughly how old is your 701? Is it already out of warranty, Eugene? Go ahead.
I'm in 6K2KY.
Okay, Sam.
It's out of warranty. It's a very old radio, but it's a brand new radio. Just came out of the case. We have another breaker, W2EWK.
Yeah, this unknown breaker is a guy named Mel, K2KY. Hey, Mel, let me give you my apologies that I didn't get a chance to show up. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, I sat all night waiting for you. I operated. I made a lot of contacts. Frank needs to hear all the whole operation, but this guy pounded out hundreds of contacts. He's a very skilled contest operator, WB2BXO. I have radio here from the Kenwood. Similar problem. I not only had to take the front off, it's behind the back lighting, back that display. In other words, the display actually has a, on top, you know, those finger contacts, the flex material, but you got to also tilt it up very gently, and the knock-on button thing is right behind that. I mean, I don't understand what that went in their mind, the way they hit this thing, like, it would never go bad, Dick, over.
Wow, that's not exactly what I would call high maintainability. My goodness. So you have to take it apart. The back of the radio, the front of the radio, the front panel, the display, tilt up the display, and behind the display in the front is where the watch battery, lithium or mercury battery is contained. Wow. So, either the manual or dig a little bit further. It looks like it's the right answer, Eugene. W2EWK, you got it.
Okay, very good there, Dick. I want to see if I can get, I'm going to call him up and see if I can get a piece of that deal. Technician, my head can't think correctly, but you know what I'm talking about, you know, the technician book, and see if I can, you know, get a picture of it and see how to do it from Kenwood. Maybe they'll send me, you know, the technician book. Okay, Dick, thank you very much for your help, and thank you all your other people, and I'm going to wish everyone happy 4th of July, and make sure you don't play with fireworks and keep all your fingers. Okay, W2EWK clear.
WS, do you want to comment on that radio?
Very fine, Paul. We'll get to you in a second. Good luck with that one, Eugene. And it's the service manual you're looking for. Occasionally, a good manufacturer will give you a schematic diagram of the rig, just with the operating or owner's handbook, but service manual is what you're looking for. Paul, WS2N, you got it.
Yeah, I think a lot of Kenwoods are probably done like that. I know Mel has the same problem. On the 440, the same thing. You got to fold it down, and it's behind it's actually set behind the panel and on the cover after you fold it down. But on top of that, you know, it's one of those quarter-sized batteries. I think something 32 or 32 comes to mind. But this battery, you normally could buy in a CVS. But the one that's on there has connections coming out of it. You can't just even go and buy one from Radio Shack or something to replace it. You had to send away for this battery. I think it was $11 or something for mine. It came with a lead on it, and then you plug the lead in. And that was the only way you could replace this thing. It's not something you could pop in. I mean, I was even thinking if I had the room, I was going to have maybe get one of those little component from Radio Shack that you could, you know, put a battery in, a battery holder, and it, you know, and then on a permanent basis and wire with it. But there's just no room back there, and Mel would agree with that. So yeah, he might even find himself sending away for it. My guess is a lot of Kenwoods were made that way. Nothing like the flash memory that they have today. Back to you, sir.
And 2RSO had the same problem with the Kenwood 741.
And RSO, how did you solve that?
I started contact onto the battery that I picked up at the local drugstore.
Wow. Yeah, they come with welded tabs, and to solder on there, you have to go to a high enough temperature that could damage the battery. A dangerous procedure. Also, it's a kind of a stainless steel that without the right kind of a tinner's fluid, very hard to make solder stick to the battery itself. Difficult process. I think the right solution is to try to get a hold of the battery, the watch battery, with the welded on tabs. And since it's a Kenwood product, and getting parts out of Kenwood is a little bit of a rigmarole. Is that what you did, Paul? Did you order the parts through Kenwood, or once you had the battery model number with the welded on tab, were you able to get it from somewhere else? In other words, I'll bet you there's a medium good chance that ICOM also uses a similar battery on one of their products. As such, you call up Bellevue, Washington, you talk to ICOM, you tell them what part you need. In most cases, they'll mail you the part and bill you, and you get it super quick. So how did you actually get the right part in your hand, Paul? WS2M, K2RAW?
I tried Kenwood, and like I said, that was a nightmare just to get a hold of them. I went through a battery company in New Jersey. I don't have it handy, of course. I have to search all my papers, but there was a company in New Jersey. All batteries, I forget the name. He used to have, I wonder if I still have it, one of these magnets that you attach to your refrigerator had the name on it on the old book years ago. And I feel they're still in business. I mean, they sell batteries for everything, camcorders or whatever. So once you give them the number, they'll cross-reference and send it to you. It was a lot less expensive than what Kenwood was going to charge. It probably was going to half the price back here.
Yeah, ordering parts through Kenwood is a bit difficult. You have to find out who the local dealer is. You call up the local dealer and say, I need so-and-so part. He orders it from Kenwood. It comes to his shop. Then you have to come to his shop and hand him cash in order to get it. And if you're real lucky, you can talk him into mailing it to you, as long as he's got the money and it's already been cashed. It's a very troublesome process, as I found, to get parts through Kenwood, whereas ICOM is super easy. I wonder if Mel, if any of your guys in the Kings County Radio Club have found a good way of getting a similar size battery, similar voltage battery, with welded on tabs. Have you guys found a way of getting around that one? K2KEY, K2RIW in the segment.
This is K2KEY. I tell you exactly what I did for the Kenwood here. The there was one in the catalog. What the hell was the name of it now? I'm so tired, I tell you. I just got in a little while ago. Well, you unpacked everything, so I'm a little bit behind the times, as they say. But I remember there was a catalog or a sheet that came that has parts for computers. And they have, in some of the computers, they use that. They have in, soldered in the two tabs to the board. And that was the make board. I can't remember, but I remember I got it. I saw it in the book, in the catalog pick. It'll come to me whose catalog it was, but there it was with its welded on tabs. No, don't go to Kenwood. Oh, there it is. It's unbelievable. You know what they tell you, the ridiculous things with this one I'm using here. They quoted the guy who had this thing really new, and he killed it. He killed it. I mean, by just hooking things up and doing things wrong, but it's a new radio, basically. And when he asked, when he, you know, sent it to Kenwood, basically, I think they quoted him with shipping and labor and everything like that because out of warranty, about $5 more than the radio cost new then. So they're hard people to deal with, especially with anything, especially when it comes to parts, over.
So you
mean to
the CDO. I have some info.
Okay, Andy recognized. Go right ahead, Andy.
Good evening, guys. I'm in the, in the car and heading over to the store like normal. I hope everybody enjoyed their weekend with Field Day. I got tied up with a lot of other things. But I will say what I've done in the past, and it's very easy to do, they actually make a holder. It's a plastic holder for these little watch batteries, the 3-volt watch batteries, the same size. And you could buy that little holder, it's not that expensive, from DigiKey. If you look at their DigiKey catalog on their website, you'll see it's a little plastic holder that'll actually hold the battery in place, and it's got tabs coming out of it. Now, the tabs will not fit into the pre-drilled holes that Kenwood has for their original battery, but that's not a problem because you just take two wires, take a red and black wire, a little hookup wire, and solder it onto the tabs of the holder, and then from there, place it through the hole where the original battery went and solder it to the circuit board. Then, to stop it from flopping around, take some sticky back tape and place it inside the compartment of the 742. And press the holder up against it. Now you got a nice solid battery that's not going to wobble around, and it's in a holder. And you can open up the holder anytime and change the battery. So that's the easy way. Dick?
It won't work. I tried it.
Yeah, on the first question I'm going to ask you, first of all, Eugene's doing this with a TM701, which is a little bit more compact than the 742. How thick is that battery holder? Andy, I'm worried about the fact that Eugene's radio is so compact and the battery is probably hidden behind it, is what he may not have the room for the holder unless the holder is almost identical in thickness to the battery with tabs. But there's one other thing I want to mention, and a lot of us don't know this. Take any part in the world that's buried in the middle of a radio, which has a real part number on it from a manufacturer. You simply go to Google and type in that number. You'll be amazed that about 90% of the time, Google will find somebody that will sell you that object. As long as you've got a real part number. I mean, that surprised the daylights out of me. Sounds like Mel wanted to say something on this one. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I'll tell you how you deal with these people. The part numbers only mean something to them. And there are, in many cases, a crossover from, like, say, Kenwood to a generic company that makes batteries. No crossovers, because everything is just there for their own private use. I tried that. I thought of the same idea because I've had a lot of computer boards that I broke up and, you know, threw away, and they had those 3-volt silver cells. So I thought, yeah, I'll get that in. I'll take care of it like heck. There's no room. You can't push the display back in place. The display will not lay flat. It's just ridiculous on this pen, which I have had the same exact. I figured every jar's on way, Dick, and I finally said, nothing I can do about it. I just got to get the battery and be finished, because there is no leeway, nothing, nothing much as being able to put a sheet of paper in there, over.
I got to, hold on. I got to jump out of the car. I'm here at the store. I'll be back, because I want to find out about this radio you're talking about. I thought it was for 742, and that radio's got plenty of room. Dick, WHCD, I'll be right back.
Okay, we'll hold your place, Andy. Mel, once again, was it that company in New Jersey that sold you the exact battery or a similar battery with welded-on tabs? Back to you, Mel.
I can't think of the name of this company. They send out these flyers a lot of times. I get them. It's like a white book, a long one. And in there, they had a whole bunch of tons of all kinds of batteries. And there the heck was one of those batteries that they, I can say, they use them in some of the computers, but they started with the welded-on tabs. I don't remember the name of the darn thing. So, on this one, this is the, what the heck is it? The T2, T201, TM-280 one. This is a 2-meter version. Then I got a 440 version, like the identical. And the son of a gun, the way they did this thing, it's like, oh, the heck with you people. You know, it really unusually went out of their way to make life difficult over.
All electronic.
All electronics. There's also batteries, RF, and places like that, but all electronics. Does it sound like the right one, Mel?
I think that may be it. Yeah, all electronics. They had a couple of pages of all kinds of oddball batteries, you know, for computers and all. And give you the dimensions, you know, thickness, diameter, and the whole bit, and so whether they have tabs or no tabs. So you'll find the battery there in one of them. But if you're going to go to Kenwood, take the Kenwood part number and then try to do something with it. Oh, you are a lost soul, Vic. You'll be pulling your hair out of your head, literally, as they say. Better off go elsewhere because, first of all, you're going to buy a single lot. That's another thing with them. You know, minimum orders. You're not talking about that the battery is to be a $5 thing, but the minimum order is $25, remember, over.
Yeah, the 25 wouldn't bother me too much. But all the rigmarole of getting money first, ordering the part, they order it from somewhere mysterious. It comes to their store, and you got to go to their store to pick it up. A lot of rigmarole. Okay, looks like we haven't completely finished on Eugene's request for that that battery location in his TM-701A radio and where he's going to get that battery when he gets it in his hands. Unfortunately, he's probably going to have welded on tabs as Andy CPO and others come back with some more information there for you, Eugene, so hang in there. The next person who wanted to make a comment was Bill, WB2CUK. Go right ahead, Bill.
And I'm back also, WB2CUK.
Okay, Andy first. Go ahead, Andy. You got good information on where he can get a battery with welded tabs?
Hey, because I don't want to hold Bill up. Just a question. Which radio is this? I thought it was a 742, but it's a different model?
Roger, Dodger. Tango Mike 701 Alpha. 701A. You got it there, Andy.
There's got to be room in that radio somewhere. You don't have to have the battery where it's located. You could extend the lead. Usually around the final amplifier compartment, there's room.
Another good suggestion. Yeah, most likely when he lifts up the display, he's going to find zero room behind there. And good idea. The battery doesn't have to be there. The wires can be brought in from some other location. There's a zillion ways to solve the problem, as they say. Let's go over to Bill. Is it B2CUK? You got it, Bill.
Come back to me, Dick. I've got to ask a question about this.
Okay. Poor Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
I extended the wires on one of them just to try it out to see if the odd thing will work. You know, and just connected it to a power source. In fact, when I hooked to the power source, it didn't work. So I said, they got to have batteries. For some reason, explain to me why, when I lengthen the leads, I use like 6-inch or 8-inch long leads. Why doesn't it work right? Explain that to me. I couldn't for the life of me. Now, I've run into this before on other items where if you try to hook like a power supply to this item separately or whatever, send the battery, for some reason, it won't work right. Tell me why.
Voltage drops. I've got a guess on that one, Mel. And that is some of these integrated circuits are very RF sensitive. We all forget about the fact that inside of our handy-talky radio, there are some fierce, strong electrostatic and electromagnetic fields. There's some very strong fields inside that radio. Quite possibly, Kenwood stuffed the battery in that very difficult-to-get location because that was one of the few places that was radio quiet enough that there wouldn't be excess pickup. When the battery leads, acting as an antenna because they're now extended, pick up enough RF energy and shove that RF energy into that integrated circuit chip, terrible things can happen. I first ran into this problem on the George L. Belke, JLB, whatever this, that very first synthesizer that came out in the late 70s, where you literally took this synthesizer by this company that built a kit in the Buffalo area, and you plugged it into the crystal socket of your radio, and instead of buying a zillion crystals,
this GLB synthesizer, George LB synthesizer. It probably had a model number to it, too. You could, therefore, not have to buy a zillion crystals. It would get every possible frequency you want by twisting its rotary dials. That is, rotary dials for the transmitter and rotary dials for the receiver. Beautifully designed piece of equipment. That's the good news. The bad news is that all of a sudden we all started using PL tones, and various companies were building PL tone generators. You put the PL tone generator inside of the GLB synthesizer, and terrible things happen. But what you soon discover is that the signal coming out of the PL tone generator gets picked up by its antenna lead, so to speak, and gives you a phase shift to the synthesizer function of all the countdown circuits. And it really drove the synthesizer crazy. I decided to really do a real good electromagnetic compatibility, electromagnetic interference solution to the problem. Let me drop. And step by step by step, I ended up building a very secure aluminum box around the GLB synthesizer with all six sides, having a zillion screws all screwed together so that it was an RF-type box. All the B-plus leads going in and the digital leads coming out were all properly bypassed, and the tone generator was put in just the right spot. I managed to make it work. It probably took a month of my spare time in order to do it. So you'd be amazed how sensitive some of these modern-day integrated circuits are to stray RF fields. So I guarantee there's a way of getting the battery remotely into that with wires extended into that chip. But I think the battery itself and its wiring is going to have to be well shielded, and the shielding itself is going to have to be grounded very near the chip itself. So RF pickup is my best guess. Anybody got any comments on this? Give me a call. It is right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I could say something.
You're
again.
You got it, Andy.
I've done this a number of times and never had a problem. On a number of different radios, Kenwood, ICOM, Yaesu's, and never had a problem. And it's true, I did use shielded cable because one side of the battery goes directly to ground. And also, on some of the radios, not all of them, they are bypassed, RF bypassed, with little chip caps that are on the leads of the battery itself, when, you know, the solder on battery. Where it's tied to the circuit board, but I never had trouble, and I don't think UG will have it either if he extends it and places it where he can, and if he does, all right, it may take some careful repositioning, but with like you say, good shielded cable and RF bypassing, I don't think there'll be a problem with that. It's my opinion.
Okay, with the proper techniques, I'm reasonably positive it could be working. Anybody who's done television interference elimination and has done it for a long enough period of time will realize that every interference problem with proper filtering, bypassing, shielding, and whatever is solvable. Every single interference problem is solvable. I didn't see how long it's going to take you. I didn't say how much heroic effort you're going to have to put forward to do it. But they're all solvable, so don't give up. Okay, Bill, that it be CUK, you better grab it in a hurry before somebody else does, Bill. K2LIW is the TechNet.
Hi, Jack. Very good. Well, I'm busy disassembling a little Viboplex bug and giving it a good cleaning. And my question is totally out of left base compared to what you guys are talking about tonight with batteries. I may have asked you this question once before, but in the light of field day this weekend, and me trying to copy stations here at home with my little whip antenna in the house and not having much success getting more line noise than anything, I have an antenna question. If I should take, let's say randomly, about 200 feet of wire and take one end, stick it into the coax, the center of the coax, run it all around, up my roof, over the trees, as high into the trees as I can get it, and then bring it back down and take the other end and ground it to the ground of the radio. Will that work better than if I just left that end free? And I haven't tried this. I have 200 feet of wire, but I haven't exercised myself to throw it out to the trees and try that. But I'm
wonder what your opinion would be. If it would work 200 feet open-ended, would work better than if I had it all looped around and then grounded to the radio. If that would eliminate some of the...